Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here, early. Right now at Wayfair, get up to 70% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, holiday decor, and way more. Now is the time to score big, from seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, with Wayfair, enjoy fast and easy shipping, with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 70% off early Black Friday deals. Shop now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Let's talk. Talk.
Johnny Brown.
The Strange Death of David Kelly is a new book by Norman Baker looking at the high-profile death of government weapons inspector David Kelly 21 years ago and its repercussions. Delighted to say that the book is being published, was published yesterday, I believe, and Norman Baker joins us live on the line now. Norman, good morning to you.
Good morning to you too.
Good to have you with us once again. Let's go back 21 years ago, which again, time flies, isn't it? Because you think it's a blink of an eye and it's over two decades ago. Who was Dr. David Kelly to begin with?
David Kelly was one of the greatest arms weapons inspectors in the world. He was recognised as such by United Nations and by others. He did sterling work in uncovering weapons of mass destruction in places like Russia and Iraq. And he was a great tribute to this country, a great recognition of the fact that he should have been given an award, I think, for his work. But he wasn't given an award. Instead, he was found dead on Harrowdown Hill in suspicious circumstances in 2003 in the middle of the weapons of mass destruction issue the government had raised. Of course, there were no weapons of mass destruction. He was brought in and made it plain that he thought there were exaggerations to the government's case. They were turning, in the words of Hans Blix, the UN weapons inspector, turning question marks into exclamation marks. And that was very inconvenient for the government for him to be saying these things.
Those words, weapons of mass destruction, we remember this was a pivotal point for Tony Blair getting involved in the invasion of Iraq with the US forces. So when did Dr. Kelly start pointing out, if you like, that this was not the case?
Well, he had an interview unofficially, I think, with a reporter from the BBC, Andrew Gilligan, and that resulted in a broadcast at 6:07 one morning on the BBC Today programme when it was claimed by Andrew Gilligan that David Kelly had said there were likely to be no weapons of mass destruction present. And given the fact that the government was misleading Parliament and, in fact, giving the alleged existence of weapons of mass destruction as a reason for going to war, that was quite a significant matter.
So what was the response of Tony Blair, the government, because we had gone into Iraq, of course. There was the original sort of thing had been to go into a sort of Afghanistan in the wake of 9/11, etc., 21 years ago. So what was the reaction of Blair's government when this interview, this BBC interview was aired?
Well, they went apoplectic. Alistair Campbell, who was the government spin doctor, then launched a war against the BBC. And I use the term quite deliberately. He went to war with the BBC and was determined to get them to back down and to exact revenge on them. I mean, it really was that. And the government made sure that David Kelly was presented as some sort of Walter Mitty character, which he certainly wasn't.
Obviously, Alistair Campbell, spin doctor is supreme. Presumably, he got the most of the broadsheet press then on Kelly's back. How what was Kelly's reaction like when, as you said, the government apoplectic? Was he concerned? Was he sticking to his principles? What was his reaction to their reaction, as it were?
He was very, I think he was put in a difficult position because he wasn't used to being in a public spotlight. He became, for a short period of time, the most famous person in Britain, and he didn't like that position. He was then subject to very public questioning by the Foreign Affairs Committee and less public, but still questioning by the Intelligence and Security Committee. So he had to deal with all this. I think he stood up quite well. And the indications are on the morning when he was last seen alive, as it were, he was in good humour. He'd booked a return flight to the Middle East to carry on his work. He'd been sending emails to people saying that the worst was over, In other words, he was not suicidal.
Because what's the timeline like then between the BBC interview and the government's reaction, and then the discovery of Dr. Kelly's body then?
Well, Dr. Kelly's body was found in late July that year. The BBC programme had been a couple of weeks beforehand. There wasn't, you know, the whole thing was concentrated and telescoped down into quite a short period of time.
So what was the immediate reaction, because I do remember this, seems to be he's gone into the woods, the pressure's got too much for him, he's taken his own life, case closed. And everybody sort of tended to move on from there without much thought really into this, because... And it's a particular thing, isn't it? We are at war, therefore you have to be on our side. If you're not with us, you are against us, etc. Is that the sort of the prevailing mood of, well, at least the political class at the time?
Well, I mean, look, there were one or two, inverted commas, journalists, I use the term advisedly, who came out immediately before Dr. Kelly's body was even cold to say, oh, he committed suicide. They had no way of knowing that. They weren't on site. They hadn't seen anything. The police were treating it as a crime scene at that particular point. So one wonders why these journalists were out there on the media moving matters on to something else and who they were actually working for. The government itself announced an inquiry, an informal inquiry, non-statutory inquiry, no powers, no proper process under Lord Hutton, who, by the way, never chaired an inquiry in his life before. Lord Hutton was appointed that morning, having been found in the House of Lords on a Friday, which is almost impossible to find someone in the House of Lords on a Friday. And by lunchtime, he was up and running, and the story moved on to being an inquiry chaired by Lord Hutton, which turned out to be about the BBC versus the government. Poor Dr. Kelly barely got a look in. So one wonders why the government was so keen and so fast and so able to announce an inquiry when it wasn't even clear how Dr. Kelly had died at that particular point. Still isn't clear, as a matter of fact, because no inquest has been held into his death. But the government was clearly keen to move the story on, and he did so successfully.
The BBC, was John Burt the head of the BBC at that point? Who was the head of the BBC?
No, that was Gavin Davison and Guy Dyke, who were the two at the top of the BBC.
And they resigned. I mean,
they had to resign. I mean, there was such a war from Alistair Campbell that they held on to the publication of the Hutton inquiry, which was a complete travesty in all regards. The following January, I think it was, and which blamed the BBC for everything, blamed the government for nothing, and barely looked at David Kelly. Just on David Kelly, Lord Hutton subsequently wrote in a racy publication called the Inner Temple Yearbook. I know that you've seen it. I know your listeners have read it very avidly.
Every week,
absolutely. He hadn't bothered investigating David Kelly's death very much because it seemed obvious what had happened. I mean, what kind of an inquiry is that? But anyway, his publication blamed the BBC for everything. Greg Dyke and Gavin Davis had to resign. Well, they did resign. And then Richard Ryder, who was the vice chairman of the BBC, came out and apologised to the government for what the BBC had done, and in my view, destroyed 80 years of BBC independence in that statement, which they've never recovered from.
What? I mean, people are always going about conspiracy theories. I mean, it's de rigueur. But this screams whitewash, brushed under the carpet, let's not go in any further investigation. And we're 21 years away from this. People are looking very hard at these events. What was the spark for you that was the genesis of your book, The Strange Death of David Kelly?
Well, I mean, first of all, it was very clear that his death wasn't being talked about, and we suddenly moved on within 24 hours talking about the BBC and the government. Why were we not talking about David Kelly? And there were letters appearing in the papers from medical experts who said, hang on a minute, David Kelly could not have died this way, medically impossible to have died this way. That was not being taken seriously either. And none of the mainstream papers were actually looking at this in the detail they should have done. So in the absence of that, I did it myself. And the more I looked into it, the more unhappy and concerned I became. Let me just deal, if I can, with the alleged reasons for death.
Yeah.
But by the way, the death certificate was produced before the inquiry took place. That's an interesting way of dealing with things, isn't it? But the death certificate said he died from hemorrhage caused by incised wounds to the left wrist. Now, let's just look at this. Allegedly, he used a knife to cut the ulnar artery, which is a tiny matchstick thickness artery in your wrist. Medical experts say it's almost virtually impossible to die from just cutting the ulnar artery. So that's a suspicious matter for a start. Secondly, the knife was blunt. And if you use a blunt knife on these matters, then it heals more quickly than if you use a very sharp knife. So that also makes it less likely. Then you got the situation that David Kelly was an expert in death, if you like, from his work, and he would not have chosen such an uncertain way to kill himself. Then he was supposed to have used his right arm because the wound was in his left wrist. His right arm had been damaged in an accident, and Mike Pedersen, one of his best friends who works for the CIA, said that he'd had lunch with her or dinner with her shortly beforehand, and his right arm was so damaged he couldn't cut steak with it. So why would David Kelly use a damaged right arm which couldn't cut steak to allegedly cut into his left wrist? Then the people who found him, Louise Hope was one of the volunteers who found him, didn't know how he died because there's no evidence of any blood anywhere. So none of this adds up in terms of the cutting of the left wrist. He's also supposed to have died from ingestion of coproximal tablets. That's the second reason given on the death certificate.
Right.
Coproximal tablets. There was a blister, three blister packs in his pocket with 29 tablets missing and one still there, no doubt to tell the police what they were. Very helpful, no doubt. Only a fifth of a tablet was found in his stomach. What happened to the other 28 and four-fifths tablets? We don't know. But here's something else. David Kelly had an aversion to swallowing tablets. His wife said that at the Hutton inquiry. So why would somebody who had averse to swallowing tablets choose to swallow 29 coproximal tablets as a way of killing himself? And why is it that having to swallow 29 tablets, he only drank apparently a third of a small bottle of water in order to down them all? I mean, none of this makes any sense.
So why wasn't there more? Do you think more outrage or shock or wasn't there more investigation at the time? I mean, does it go back to my previous point that people saying we have to move on because we are now at war?
Well, I think it's so much sort of war, because it's really because the media moved on because the whole focus was on the BBC versus the government at the Hutton inquiry. That's what the story was. And because a couple of people come out very early and said he committed suicide, people just took that for granted that that was the case and didn't look into it very carefully. You know, here's the fact. I did a freedom of information request to Thames Valley Police, the local area police, and said, what fingerprints were on the knife used to kill David Kelly? What was on the water bottle that was next to him? I did that after the Hutton inquiry had reported. The Hutton inquiry didn't ask those basic questions. I mean, it's an obvious question to ask. Lord Hutton didn't ask the question. Do you know what the answer was? There were no fingerprints on the knife and no fingerprints on the water bottle. And David Kelly wasn't wearing gloves. So what we're supposed to conclude from that? That he's kind of carefully wiped his fingerprint off after he used a knife, come off it.
You mentioned that David Kelly has also been sending emails that day. And I know that's not a, you know, people can seem to be in the best of spirits and we don't know the quote-unquote hidden trauma, as we tend to see in the sad case of suicide. But, you know, you said he'd sent emails. He was in a good frame of mind. He'd been for lunch with friends, you know, earlier in that week. Presumably, this isn't stack up for somebody who is who's looking to, if you like, you know, tie the loose ends of their life up before committing suicide.
No, I mean, look, he was Baha'i faith, and the Baha'i faith has an absolute prohibition on suicide. That's one thing. Secondly, his wife was ill. Do you commit suicide when your wife's not very well? Thirdly, his daughter's about to get married. Then fourthly, he'd been sending emails saying he was looking forward to getting back to Iraq, and he bought his airline ticket or had it bought for him. He did send in emails, comments about dark actors playing games. We never found out who those dark actors were or what the games were, but that was in one of the emails he sent. None of this adds up to a person who, those who know him very well say he was never the sort of person to commit suicide. I know sometimes you can't tell that, but that was a consistent view from anybody who knew him, that he was never going to do that. So, you know, the medical evidence doesn't stack up to suicide. The psychological evidence doesn't stack up to suicide. And you have to ask yourself why it is that Lord Hutton concluded it was suicide. It was an informal inquiry. Let's be quite clear about this. There was no inquest. The inquest was begun by the Oxfordshire coroner. The Oxfordshire coroner was bundled off the case by the government, who said, no, you can't investigate this. Lord Hutton's doing it. Lord Hutton had never chaired an inquiry before. He'd never chaired an inquest before. This particularly so-called inquiry of his was informal, no more formal than me talking to you today. Key witnesses weren't called. The police officer in charge of the investigation wasn't called to give evidence. My Pedersen, his best friend, who knew he had damaged his arm, wasn't called to give evidence. The police told Lord Hutton she had nothing of value to say, therefore don't bother calling her. That's really interesting in itself, isn't it? Nobody was cross-examined under oath. There was no proper process there. People could have lied and got away with it because there was no proper court process going on there. And there was a whole lot of contradictory statements from the police about what had actually happened. What did Lord Hutton say in his report? He said, well, the fact that there were contradictory statements shows they're all telling the truth. Because if they'd been all saying the same thing, they'd have stitched up the story. That was his explanation for that.
So we have an investigation that is incompetent on the one hand, and you know, we're talking dark forces here, but you know, for a man who's got a problem with his right hand to cut his arm with a blunt knife, and then magically expel 29 3/4 tablets from his body into thin air on half a glass of water or whatever, and then leave no fingerprints. I mean, you know, those of us who watch too many crime dramas may think, well, this is obviously the work of the Feathermen or something like that.
Well, look, I mean, if it's a proper inquest, a verdict of suicide can only be reached if you are convinced, if the coroner's convinced or the jury's convinced, quote, beyond reasonable doubt. That's the high threshold for suicide. Otherwise, you reach an open verdict. I challenge anyone to tell me that the evidence that is being produced here that exists from David Kelly's death gives you a conclusion beyond reasonable doubt of suicide. It just doesn't add up. It's simply impossible to reach that conclusion. But how convenient for the government that conclusion was reached, because it puts all the blame on David Kelly and not on anybody else.
So if Dr. Kelly is taken out of the picture by nefarious means, shall we say, and 21 years later you come back and start stirring the pot and shining a light on this, do you not have a little bit of worry that this might come back onto you yourself?
Well, I think it may well do. I don't know, but that's not a reason not to do it. I mean, the fact of the matter is I believe in truth and I believe in honesty and I believe in proper processes in government. And we haven't had those things. And somebody needs to call that out. Look, I mean, when I first raised this, it was very popular with the public, by the way, because I had more letters about this than anything I've ever done in my public life before. Huge number of letters. That's testament to the fact that it wasn't just me concerned about this, it was a whole lot of the public concerned about this. But, you know, within the political circles, it probably did me damage. But, you know, that's not a reason not to do it. And by the way, although not many politicians have come out and said things, there are politicians who came up to me from all three parties and said, we think you're right. But they wouldn't say so publicly, but they said so privately, including, by the way, one leader of the Conservative Party.
What do you think, then, Norman, happened to Dr. Kelly? Do you think it is he was taken out by, you know, by order of somebody in a department somewhere? What do you think happened to him?
Well, I'm tempted to say you should buy the book and find out. But Let me say this. I'm convinced beyond any doubt that it is not suicide. It cannot be suicide. And therefore, some other explanation has to apply. So either by definition, he died of natural causes, or he was murdered. That's the only other explanations which exist. Some people think that what happened was he was being subject to intense interrogation by the Ministry of Defence, and he had a heart attack on them. And it was so embarrassing to admit that they had to create a suicide to cover it up. I've also set out people who may have the reason to deal with them in my book. They're all 10% chances. There's no obvious answer to it. There's a number of 10% chances. But what we have to focus on is this: A, it's not suicide, and B, there's no inquest. And what I want to come out of this book being published is I want an inquest. I want a proper process. Dr. Kelly's entitled to that.
The book is called The Strange Death of David Kelly. It's by Norman Baker, who we're speaking to today. It has been described as a stunning work of non-fiction. You can order it via our own virtual bookstore, of course, at tre.radio. Norman, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.